Blog Talk Radio.
It's good to be back. As you know, I've been gone for the last 4 weeks or so. Hopefully you've enjoyed the shows of those who filled in for me. Today, I want to talk about basic income, guaranteed basic income. This is all over the news. It's been, it's been touted by Nobel Prize, a lot of it. It's been touted by people on the radical left. On the middle of the left, on the right, across the entire political spectrum, including many, many libertarians who are big advocates of this idea of a basic minimum income. So today, I want to talk about what that is, why it's so attractive. Why do so many people, left, right, center, find it so interesting and so appealing? And then how to analyze it and how to look at it and what are the issues that it raises or doesn't raise. But, a lot of this, I guess, was my attention was focused on this. It's been focused on this for a while because I've seen pieces about this really for months, certainly over the last, I'd say, 2 or 3 years. This keeps coming up. But on Friday, the Wall Street Journal published an editorial by, a leading thinker in the world in which we live. No matter what you think of him, he is a substantial figure. That's Charles Murray. Charles Murray of the American Enterprise Institute is considered kind of a cross between a conservative and libertarian. He describes himself as a libertarian. And he came out for a guaranteed income for every American. The subtitle of the article is Replacing the Welfare State with an Annual Grant is the Best Way to Cope with the Radically Changing U.S. Job Market and Revitalizing America's Civic Culture. So we'll get to that, because this idea that there's a fundamental problem with the job market that's different than in any other point in time in human history, that it has to be solved and that the only way to solve it is through a minimum guaranteed income, is an issue that is raised both left, right, center. Almost everybody raises this this issue. Also, I don't know how many of you know, but Finland has decided that it's going to experiment with this idea of a minimum guaranteed income, and those experiments are scheduled for next year. We'll talk about that. It's not exactly this Charles Murray approach. Theirs is much more of a hybrid, partially because they're only experimenting. I think there's also a referendum in Switzerland about this. While the Swiss parliament has voted down a minimum guaranteed income or guaranteed minimum income or whatever, this is going to go to people. And opinion polls show it's very popular, this idea of having some kind of minimum income is quite popular, and we're going to get into all the details. I've got one question here online: how does a basic minimum income replace the welfare state rather than just expand it? We'll get to that. We'll talk about what they mean by replace it, and whether really it is replacing, and what are the different arguments. It's also worth noting that well-known people like F.A. Hayek and Milton Friedman are quoted as supporting the idea of a basic minimum income. Now, as you know, one of Ayn Rand's harsh critiques against both Hayek and Milton Friedman was that they were inconsistent, that they were not consistent advocates of rights. So it shouldn't become as too much of a surprise that Friedman and Hayek would be pro this idea. But so we're going to try to unpackage this. We're going to try to see what it is that's so appealing about it. and why, and ask the question, you know. So let's say as objectivists, right, as advocates of Ayn Rand's philosophy, we don't believe in any redistribution of wealth, and we don't believe in any kind of in any taking from some people to give to others, violation of rights. Could this be a transition? Could this be a policy that would work well in transition to a world in which there was no redistribution of wealth at all? But there's something, and I have to admit, there's something very, very appealing about the minimum income guarantee, specifically when compared to the existing system. So let's start by saying a few things about the existing welfare state and the existing system. And I had a bunch of statistics here. Let's see if I can find them. So in the United States today, right? And my guess is that this is mimicked in Europe. Some countries probably have a little bit greater efficiency here, and some countries have less efficiency, more programs, less programs, and so on. But let's look at the existing welfare state, right? Right. Today in the United States, we have 126 at the federal level. This is just the federal level. 126 separate anti-poverty programs. Right, anti-poverty. I put that in quotes because whether any of them have anything to do with poverty is a separate question. But 126 separate programs that are supposed to be anti-poverty. Almost 110 million Americans receive benefits from one or more of these programs, which cost taxpayers something around, as of 2013, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, really, $688 billion. $688 billion. You know, I could do a lot of stuff with $688 billion. Wouldn't it be fun? Right? We could change the world with $688 billion. Anyway, that's what these 126 separate anti-poverty programs. Now, note, this does not include things like, and this is not an all-inclusive list, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid does not include, I think, unemployment insurance. So this does not include some of the biggest programs we're talking about. So, Medicare in and of itself is probably as big as this, if not, and will be much, much bigger in future years, and we'll talk about that. Obamacare in and of itself does not cost that much money. Obamacare is not primarily a system of redistribution of wealth. It's primarily a system of regulating healthcare, regulating insurance policies, and regulating the delivery mechanism by which healthcare is delivered. The primary way in which the United States subsidizes healthcare directly is Medicare and Medicaid, primarily at the federal level Medicare, primarily at the state level Medicaid. All right. Now that's federal level, $688 billion. At the state and local level, we have additional funding, and they of about $255 billion in 2013. So the total, if you add everything up and you round it off a little bit, it's around $1 trillion. $1 trillion. And if you look at the last 50 years or since the establishment of the war on poverty, I love that, war on poverty. We've got tanks out there rolling and firing at poverty and trying to kill as many poverty as possible. Since the start of the war on poverty in 1965, people have to learn that you can't have a war on phenomena. You can't have a war on things. You can't have a, you know, you, anyway. War on poverty in 1965, the United States at the federal, state, and local government has spent $20 trillion. $20 trillion. Again, a lot of money. A lot of money. $20 trillion spent on the so-called war on poverty. Now, given all this, right, and this is about a massive federal and local and state bureaucracies, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are employed in this. How much have we seen a reduction in poverty? the reduction in poverty. Well, again, I don't know how these things are measured, and I don't want you coming back, well, poor people are not really poor. So let's just accept the common measurements of poverty. Let's not get into a debate about how poverty is measured, because that'll get us off track here. Although such a debate needs to happen, because what counts as poverty should be questioned, and there is a big question about what it is. But let's just accept the measurements of poverty. Has it had any impact on poverty? Well, the answer is, in terms of the percentage of people who are considered by the conventional measures to be poor, no, it has had no impact. It has no impact. Basically, since the war on poverty has been declared, the percentage of people that are declared poor is about the same. Now, poverty was declining faster, significantly faster, before the war on poverty was declared than after. Now, again, I'm talking here just about welfare programs that are defined as welfare, not things like Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid, unemployment insurance, and others. Let's just put other categories that are not exactly defined as welfare programs. So the war on poverty has had no consequences while spending $20 trillion. And this is the thing to remember, 126 separate anti-poverty programs at the federal level, right? And then a bunch, dozens, by every state. So think about that. So obviously the most obvious kind of obvious push to for this guaranteed minimum income is the idea of replacing, it's an efficiency argument, right? We've got this ridiculous complexity. We've got this ridiculous inefficiency, a massive bureaucracy, lots of different programs. They're inefficient. So let's replace them all with something very simple, something very transparent, and that is some minimal amount of money that we give every single citizen. Now note that we're giving it to every single citizen, including rich people. This is part of an important feature of the program, although Charles Murray's program has a twist, and we'll see why that necessitates a twist. Now, why give it to everybody, including Bill Gates? Why would you give this minimal basic income to Bill Gates? Well, because if you don't, if you start phasing out this government-granted check, right? So the idea is this. Let's take $10,000 per person as an amount, because it's a nice round figure, and in a sense, this is what Charles Murray is suggesting. Although, if you wanted to get rid of poverty, right? If you want to get rid of all poverty in the United States, the poverty level is defined, right? Is defined as $12,316. So. That's for a single non-elderly individual. Now, don't ask me how these things are defined and whether it makes any sense or whether all these definitions are pretty stupid. This is how it's defined, right? $12,316 per person, right there. So let's say we give every person in the United States today $12,316, a check for $12,316. Right? Poverty would go away by definition. If that's your definition of poverty, poverty would just disappear as soon as they got the check. And you would put it into a bank account on a monthly basis. And that would be the only welfare program. Again, we still haven't done away with Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. We'll get to those in a minute. Let's assume for a minute that we're not touching those. But let's assume we did this. Now, why do you give it to rich people as well? Well, the reason is that if you start phasing this out at a certain level of income, then there's a clear disincentive for people to strive to make more money, because they'd actually there are points in the distribution where they would be taxed 100% on the new income they were getting. Because for every dollar they would get, let's say, they would lose 50% of benefits. That would be like a 50% tax on every new dollar that they would gain. So the idea is, in order to not provide any disincentive, right, any disincentive for people to actually work and to strive and to make themselves better, you give it to every single person in the country. And when you give it to every single person, it creates no disincentives to work and to strive and to add another marginal dollar through hard work and entrepreneurship, right? Kind of makes sense. So let's say you give every U.S. citizen, and everybody suggests it's only U.S. citizens. You give them, and we give this to 296 million U.S. citizens. So $12,316 to 296 million U.S. citizens. This includes children, by the way. That would be $4.4 trillion. $4.4 trillion. Now, you note that $1 trillion was all we spend now. $4.4 trillion is about the size of the entire budget. I think it's greater than the entire U.S. budget, and that includes Social Security, Medicare, and everything else. Okay, so wait a minute. So this is four times more expensive than what we pay today. So you'd have to have a massive tax increase in order to afford this. But you could say, okay, but wait a minute. What we could do, and this is what Charles Murray suggests, is we could eliminate Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security as well, right? So we would eliminate Medicaid because if you give everybody $12,316, including old people, then, you know, they don't need the Social Security. They don't need Medicare because this is enough money they can use. They can use some of this money to buy health insurance in a private market. And if you do that, then, you know, that's another $1 trillion. It's another $1 trillion. And, okay, so now we're spending $2 trillion currently, and this is going to cost us 4.4. So you're still about $2.5 trillion short budget-wise, which means massive, again, increases in taxes in order to fund this massive redistribution of wealth. Okay, but Charles Murray said, but wait a minute. Okay, this is a little exaggerated, this 12,316, to give it to everybody, right? Like, by the way, with a system like this, this consumes the entire budget. So there's not, you can't, what are you going to cut spending? So he says, there's no reason to give this for children. We give this only for adults, right? And if we give it only for adults, then now it's shrinking, and it shrinks $2 trillion. So now it's getting close. Now it's kind of getting close to replacing, if you truly replace all of Medicare, all of Social Security, all of Medicaid, all of unemployment insurance, everything. Absolutely everything. And instead of that, you send every adult $12,316. Then it's now getting fairly even, right? Right? It's fairly even. So not a bad system, right? So if we paid every citizen, every adult. Now, some critics say, wait a minute, this will discourage people from having kids. I don't know. Is that a bad thing? I don't know. Would it really? I mean, the whole idea is this is a basic income. So maybe those people who would forever only live on basic income don't have kids, but they have an incentive to work in order so that they can afford kids. So you can imagine now Charles Murray proposes a slightly different idea. His says you give everybody $13,000, 3,000 of those they have to use for healthcare, which is a little random in my view, and he doesn't really explain it, the op-ed, but he says that's okay. I've got an explanation somewhere else. There's a reason why it's 3,000. So he's figured this out. He's smart, right? He's a smart guy. So everybody gets 10,000, every adult gets 10,000 net to live on. And he starts phasing it out, but he starts phasing it out like if you reach 60,000, it drops to 6,500. But it never gets lower than 6,500. And he runs the math on all this. And when you run the math on all this, this is actually, and it truly replaces every federal and state welfare program, Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid, everything, right? Then this is actually cheaper than the system we have today, or somewhere very close to the system we have today. Okay, so this is the deal, right? This is what's in front of us. And we'll get to the part of the justifications, because one justification given is inefficiency, but there are other justifications which I think are interesting. And I know some of you looked shocked. Yuan sounds like he likes this deal. Yuan actually sounds like he might have become a spending 3 weeks in Europe, he might have become a socialist. And he now is for redistribution of wealth, and he's making this sound really, really attractive. What the hell is going on here? This is what happens when I go to Europe and Israel for 3 weeks. The socialism seeps into my blood, seeps into my brain, and it really is, really, really is hard to shake off. So, you're just going to have to tolerate a slightly, moderately socialist Iran. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about Charles Murray's proposal. Don't worry. My response to all of this will come. But I do want to lay out the best possible case for this, because I think it's interesting. And again, it's being pushed by libertarians. It's being pushed by conservatives. Rubio had a variation on this. A number of other of the presidential candidates had variations of this. Friedman had a variation on this. Hayek had a variation on this. And the left is big on this. One of the biggest advocates for this is, my favorite economist, the former finance minister of Greece, Professor Varoufakis, and he has a long detailed analysis of this, and is a big supporter of minimum income. So here's a topic where both left and libertarian seem to be in agreement, and I think that's interesting, and I think it's worth thinking about, it's worth talking about, and there's an appeal here. Right, there's an appeal. You get rid of the bureaucracy. It might even be cheaper. It's transparent. You fire a lot of government employees. I'm generally great about firing. I'm all for firing a lot of government employees. I mean, there's a real attractive here, and I could actually make it more attractive, right? I could make it more attractive. Let's say, and I'll add this, and then we're going to go to a break. Let's say that not only did you provide this minimum guarantee, and you'd have to provide it a little higher if you do what I say. Not only would you do away with all welfare programs as we know it, federal, state, local. You do away with Social Security. You do away with Medicare and Medicaid. You do away with any other wealth transfer. Any redistribution of wealth would go away. But also on top of that, imagine if you did away with all public education. All public education. And instead of that, every adult in the United States got a check for whatever the amount is, $13,000, $15,000, $18,000, whatever was the reasonable amount. And of course, and it replaced all of those things. So yeah, somebody called it a voucher system for living. That's cool. A voucher says, yeah, you get a voucher. A voucher that gives you the bare necessities of life. You get education, you get healthcare, you get food. You can survive on this voucher, right? You can survive. Life stamps, there's another one, good. Life stamps, voucher system for living. But the government stepped out of everything, all these things, right? All these things, and let you make decisions about them. And then, of course, you had the incentive to better yourself, to go work and to make some money. And, of course, this would all require the taxes like we have today, or maybe a little lower, maybe a little higher. If you include education at the state level, they'd probably be lower, because that's a huge, huge part of what state expenditures are on education. So they would be taxes would be lower, certainly at the state level. But so this is the system. We're replacing all of these things that government does with a voucher system, with life stamps. What do you think? Does this make sense? I mean, clearly, if you just think about efficiency, if you think about bureaucracy, if you think about the lack, you know, one of the things that none of these people take even into account is the fact that hundreds of thousands of government employees will now be forced to find productive jobs. So, all right, what do you guys think? We'll be back right after these breaks with what you think. Oh, I don't hear the commercial. You guys hearing a commercial?
With adoring fans, rabid...
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
When The Fountainhead was first published more than 70 years ago, Ayn Rand's bold literary vision and groundbreaking philosophy of individualism captured the world's attention. Initially rejected by 12 publishers as too intellectual, the novel became an instant classic and continues to provoke heated debates. What motivates a creative thinker? Is it a selfless desire to benefit mankind, a hunger for fame, fortune, and accolades, the need to prove superiority, or is it a self-sufficient drive to pursue a creative vision independent of others' needs or opinions? Ayn Rand addresses these questions through her portrayal of Howard Roark, an innovative architect who, as she puts, struggles for the integrity of his creative work against every form of social opposition. It's also the story of his love affair with a woman who seeks to defeat him. The Fountainhead is as relevant today as it was when Rand first penned it. The novel was also a personal landmark for Rand. In Howard Roark, she presented for the first time the uniquely Ayn Rand hero, man as he could be and ought to be. Order your copy today at Amazon.com.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
How does economic inequality emerge in a free society? From a bunch of win-win transactions. When J.K. Rowling wrote her Harry Potter books, she created something of value. Seven great stories for which millions of people willingly and happily paid $10 or even $20 apiece. Now, what happened to inequality as a result? It grew. Rowling became a billionaire, starting from poverty, while her fans saw their income stay the same and their wealth go down by a tiny amount, that same $10 or $20 per book. Income inequality grew, but everyone was better off as a result. Everyone won through these win-win exchanges. That's the way inequality arises under freedom, and that's why it should. For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
ARI is now accepting applications for the Junior Fellows Program in Policy Research and Legal Studies. The program is designed for individuals who are seriously considering an intellectual career, want to gain real-world experience and training, and are interested in the application of objectivism to policy issues. The application deadline is June 15, 2016. To learn more, visit AynRand.org/JFP.
All right, so we're back. And let's be clear, because there's some questions on the chat about what anybody is proposing this would replace all welfare state programs? And the answer is yes. I mean, in Finland, the idea is that ultimately, if the pilot projects work, this would replace all other welfare programs. And the same, I think, with Switzerland. Now, they're not, and there are a lot of people, most of the people who advocate for this, certainly Charles Murray in his Wall Street Journal article, is suggesting that this replace everything. It replaced 126 federal programs, the local programs, it replaced Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. I mean, it would replace Obamacare, it would replace everything. All redistribution programs would be eliminated and replaced with one clear, transparent. You'd know exactly what you were getting. There'd be no ambiguity. You wouldn't have to have a bureaucracy to administer this, because every adult citizen of the United States would get, according to Charles Murray, $13,000. The only administration issue is you would have to use $3,000 of that for healthcare, but everything else you could use for anything. This is the proposal. Now, granted, it's easy to argue against this if the proposal is let's add this onto all the other programs. That's easy. So let's take the best case scenario. That's what we're doing here. We're taking the best case scenario. We're taking Charles Murray's proposal. Open up the Wall Street Journal from yesterday. It's a lengthy editorial in the Wall Street Journal yesterday in which this is what he's proposing. And this is Charles Murray. It's not some, second-rate thinker. It's not some bozo from the left. This is a self-defined, described libertarian, a scholar, best-selling author, all around really smart guy, right? So I want to take the best case, not the worst case. I want to take it as word. Now, the other question is, is this even politically possible? That's a completely different question. But should we be advocating for this? All right. So before we go on, we've got a phone here. I'm assuming the question on the phone is about this issue, because I really want to, we've got, 45, 46 minutes to go, and I want to make sure we really get through this issue. And I've got a lot more to say about it. You haven't even started to hear the reasons why Charles Murray and others think this is right. I mean, the economic efficiency argument is just one little argument. There are many, many arguments for this. Hi, you're on the Ron Brooks Show. Who's this?
Aloha, it's Stuart.
Hey, Stuart, how's it going?
Hi, I had to call because this really galls me. I think you can see on Twitter how I'm just livid at them disingenuously saying this replaces welfare. For them to say that, they have to have some kind of arbitrary definition of welfare, or somehow this redistribution of wealth doesn't count as welfare.
Okay, so let's change the terms of debate then, Stuart. Let's say this is a different welfare program. So we're proposing, Charles Murray's proposing to replace the existing welfare system with a new welfare system, and he's calling that welfare system a universal minimum income system. Does that still gall you?
Yes, because I think that the wealth I create belongs to me, that it's not part of some collective pie. And Charles Murray, Mr. Libertarian, is insinuating that there is no private property. Everything's collective property. It all belongs. Everything we get goes to us by permission from the state. And it's just an issue of how this is distributed.
I'm gonna get to all that, but I want to try to make the best possible argument for this possible, and then rip it to shreds. And you basically made the argument why it's wrong, why it's morally wrong, why it's morally offensive, and I'm gonna get to that. But you're absolutely right, Stuart, and I assume everybody knows that's what I think. But let's play along here, because I think it's important to understand the motives, important to understand the arguments, important to understand what they're trying to do so that we can fight it effectively. Thanks, Stuart. And thanks for tweeting your outrage at Charles Murray. That's always a good thing.
Mahalo.
Mahalo. All right. So why does Charles Murray claim that this is now urgent? And here he and Varoufakis, are completely aligned. They both argue. They both argue that this has to happen, that we have no option, that we're facing catastrophe if it doesn't happen. And the reason is that both of them see imminent, massive global unemployment out there waiting for us. And not unemployment as a consequence of people being lazy, of people not wanting to work, or people not wanting to better themselves, but unemployment that is a consequence of capitalism. Now, Varoufakis is more explicit about this. He's more out there about what he means by this. But Charles Murray, basically, that's what he's arguing. And so what is the argument? And you're hearing this more and more and more and more. And my guess is you're going to hear this more and more and more and more. This is going to be the number one economic issue. It's connected to inequality. It's connected to all these issues that people are raising. It's going to keep coming at us. And this is the Luddites argument. This is the same argument we've been hearing for 200 years about technology destroying jobs. But this time, they're right. Well, that's what they say. This time, they know they're right, as if they didn't know they were right last time. But no, this time it's completely different. Didn't they say that last time? Anyway, we are going to see a fundamental shift in our economy, a fundamental shift to artificial intelligence and robots. And don't get, I don't want an argument about artificial intelligence. What they mean by artificial intelligence, let's assume, is just really, really smart computers. Last year, a computer beat a grandmaster at the Asian board game of Go, which is like a million times more complex than chess. And he had a computer beat him, and it's about 10 years sooner than what people assumed. So the ability of computers to do complex tasks is dramatic, right? Just unbelievably dramatic. I think Charles Murray makes the point. We're soon going to have driverless cars. Let's say in 10 years. Let's say it's going to be 25, right? But soon driverless cars are going to be, we're going to have driverless cars. And he says, what's going to happen to 4 million taxi drivers and truck drivers? Right? Where are they going to go? Oh, what's going to happen to 14 million people who are now employed in production and construction when their jobs get replaced by 3D printing and contour craft technology, whatever the hell that is? But these jobs are just going to disappear. And there are no jobs to replace them. But what are they going to do? Because the jobs that you imagine that could replace them are jobs that computers can also do, and that robots can also do. Right. So technology is advancing faster and faster. I have no doubt that the technology to have driverless cars is not that far out into the future. It's more a regulatory issue about whether the government will allow driverless cars, but the technology is going to be possible within a decade or two. I mean, advancements in computing power are unbelievable. And, Moore's Law continues. And you're going to have robots that can do more and more and more and more and more things. And you're seeing across the spectrum, economists, thinkers, who are saying what's going to happen. People are not going to be able to do jobs. Now, we're not worried about really smart people, creative people, everybody knows that somebody has to build the robot, somebody has to program, somebody has to do all this stuff, right? But what's going to happen? Because the people who cannot do sophisticated jobs, manual labor, what's going to happen to them? And Charles Murray says, it's kind of funny how they rationalize this. He says, when the buggy was replaced by the automobile, it was easy to imagine other jobs that these people could do. The people who were in the buggy industry, you know, right? He says, it didn't take much imagination, I'm quoting him, to see that jobs for drivers would replace jobs lost for Teamsters, and that car mechanics would be in demand even as jobs for stable boys vanished. But this time, we can't imagine. This time it's more complicated, which is true. It is more complicated. Yeah. So what is the answer to that? I mean, to me, it's fascinating. It's fascinating, again, because it comes from smart people. It doesn't come from people who you would typically think of Luddites. Tyler Cowen, the economist from George Mason University, makes the same argument. He says the world is fundamentally changed. Employment is fundamentally going to be changed. There are going to be fewer and fewer and fewer jobs. All right. Now, I don't have an answer in the sense of a list of jobs, because I don't pretend to be the central planner who could replace jobs, X jobs, with Y jobs. Right. But I can tell you this. There are going to be jobs. All you have to know is human nature to know that our needs expand constantly. Our needs, our wants, our desires expand constantly. The ability to create goods and services that we can't imagine today expands constantly. How many of you thought you would ever use something like Facebook or Twitter? I certainly didn't. I had a problem with the cell phone. I didn't get it. It took me a long time to get cell phones. But the fact is, nobody could have imagined Facebook a year before Facebook came into existence. How many of you, and you guys are probably too young to do this thought experiment, but how many of you 30 years ago, thinking hard about the jobs of the future, would have said that a celebrity chef would become a major job, and a popular job, and a job that was admired and respected hugely in the world? Working in a restaurant, cooking food. There are more chefs today by orders of magnitude than there were 50 years ago. There are more people working in restaurants. There are more massage therapists. There are more all kinds of things, all kinds of professions that only rich people can afford, like going to restaurants, getting massages and nail. I mean, every corner in California, there's a nail salon for manicures and pedicures, fitness trainers, right? There are so many jobs that are not, that don't require technological proficiency, but that didn't exist before. But amazing is we have now, 7-8 billion people on the planet. Think of how many more jobs there are today on the planet than they were back then, 50 years ago, because there are more people and they're all working. You don't have massive unemployment today because of computers. On the contrary, you have many, 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 many more jobs today than you did back then. And yet they argue that because artificial intelligence and because computer power is getting so powerful, it's going to replace fundamental things about being human, but that assumes that we humans are not going to benefit from this computing power. I mean, I envision the day, hopefully, in the future, where, you know, in order to get you to be able to do really, really sophisticated stuff, you will have a chip implanted in your brain and you will benefit from the massive advancements in computing power. It'll be integrated into your consciousness. And you, as a human being, will be able to do things that neither man nor computer alone could do before. I mean, why is this so difficult to imagine? Right? Why is this so difficult to imagine? Entertainment. Of course, chips can interact with brains and consciousness. You want? Yep. They can graft at the electrical level. But anyway. Computer chips can't be conscious themselves, but they can certainly interact with our brain and therefore enhance our computing ability. But We'll leave it at that. I have a feeling neither Liran nor I are experts on this, in spite of the fact that he's probably going to claim he is. The fact is that there's no finite amount of work out there. There never is. There never will be for any specific type of job, for any particular skill level, for any particular IQ level, for any particular educational level. Now, it is true. The value to being educated is going to rise. And in that sense, inequality might rise because, the real returns are going to be to higher educational ability and the creation of bigger, of more exponentially accelerating values. But there's no shortage of jobs. There never has been. There never will be. There never will be. Any more than there will be a shortage of human desires or needs. Human desires or needs. Anyway, think about the fact that there's so many jobs today, so many professions today, so many millions of people working today at jobs that we couldn't have imagined 100 years ago, 50 years ago, 30 years ago, 10 years ago. 10 years ago, there are jobs today you couldn't have imagined would exist 10 years ago. The conceit of people to go around saying, oh no, this time it's different. Oh no, this time it'll happen differently. It's just nonsense. It's just nonsense. And it seems like so many people fall into this trap. So many people fall in. And Murray says, look, I know you this time, you know, the Luddites have said this forever, but I'm not a Luddite. This time really is different. It really, really is. Believe me, it really is. But he makes no compelling argument in the Wall Street Journal article or anywhere else that I've seen that this time is truly different. And I haven't seen anybody make an argument that this time is truly different. So I think the jobs argument. So the idea is, though, let's go back to a minimum basic income, is that if there are going to be no jobs, people are literally going to be starving in the streets. If they're physically, truly, in a future economy, not enough work for everybody, they cannot, metaphysically cannot, produce income to benefit themselves so that they can make a living for themselves, then we have to help them out, is the argument. Otherwise, they just starve in the streets. You know, that is so wrong on so many different levels. I mean, people could go back to subsistence farming if they were that desperate. But that's ridiculous to assume that. Think about it this way, too. And I don't have the numbers here, so you'll have to forgive me. But 100 years ago, my guess is that the average work week of a working person in Western country was somewhere between 50 and 60, maybe more than that. Today, it's somewhere around 40. Why couldn't it drop to 20? One of the ways in which this gets resolved is we only work 20 hours a day, a week. I'm the one who works 20 hours a day. So I don't know where this 40-hour work week comes from because I've never experienced it. If somebody discovers a way of how to actually work 40 hours a week, let me know. But let's say there are people who don't want to work as much as I work. You could survive very, very well in a future world where we're all wealthy and all incredibly productive and where robots are doing a lot of the jobs and where artificial intelligence is controlling a lot of the complex functions out there. Maybe you only work 15 hours a week. Maybe you only work 20 hours a week and you do other fun stuff. Maybe we all pick up lots of hobbies. I mean, careers could be thought of differently in the future than they are today. We could have multiple careers at the same time. We could have multiple jobs at the same time. Hobbies could become much more crucial. We could all become writers. We could be enjoying aesthetic experiences much more than we do today because we're so much richer. And because of that, there'd be a need for more and more and more entertainers, painters, sculptors, playwrights, actors, comedians, musicians. Think about how many people today work in the entertainment business versus 100 years ago. It's not even in the same category, right? So the richer you become, the less actual hours of the day you have to engage in work, and the more you can do other things that are interesting and fun. So I think this whole technology jobs argument is bogus, but everybody seems to make a big deal of it because if they can convince people, look, you're all going to lose your jobs and it's not going to be your fault and you're not going to find any other jobs. And we've got a solution for that. And the solution is not unemployment insurance, which doesn't pay enough and phases out, but a minimum basic income. So even if you lose a job, you can just do your hobbies for the rest of your life because you'll have enough income in order to live off. Now remember, $10,000 a year is not a lot of money. Very few people can actually live off of $10,000 a year. So there'd be an inducement to do some work, but just people wouldn't starve in the streets, which is their argument. Okay, so fear of job loss and fear of job loss as a consequence of technology as something metaphysical, not as something as a depression, as a temporary thing, but something that's permanent and everlasting. And therefore, a whole class of people, or a whole constellation of people never being able to work. That's what they're trying to address. Okay, so that's ridiculous. All right, then there's the argument which Charles Murray does not make, thank God, because he's not, at least, you know, he just knows better. But Varoufakis makes a big deal out of this. And this is the Keynesian argument, right? The problem in the world today, and I see this all over the web, is massive deflation, which I, by the way, agree. There is massive deflation, but not for the reason they think. And the problem and the reason there's massive deflation is that there's not enough aggregate demand. That is, people don't have enough money to go out and buy stuff. And we know that consumption drives the economy, according to this theory. And therefore, if we can take money from people who only save and invest and give it to people who consume, we will increase aggregate demand, increase inflation, which in their world is good for a variety of reasons, which I'll get to in a minute. And therefore, the economy will go up and everything will be great, right? So here, the idea is not so much necessarily to replace welfare, but just to give more money to the poor. The more money you could shift to the poor, the better the economy will be, because the poor tend to consume rather than, save, or as the left likes to call it, hoard. Now, I don't have enough time to go through all the things that are wrong with this, but it's just economically ignorant. People don't have any problem consuming when they have jobs, and they have jobs when businessmen invest. And businessmen invest when they believe in the future, when they think the future is favorable towards business. In an environment where you are regulating, where you're creating regulatory hurdles, where you make it very difficult to employ and fire people, when you make it very difficult to expand, when you make it very difficult to know how much of your money is left, you don't invest, you don't build, you don't hire, you create massive economic uncertainty, and people don't spend money, which then even more reduces production. So what you get here is a spiral, but the spiral starts with production. It starts with investment. The capitalist doesn't invest because he's uncertain about the future or because he's certain about the future. He thinks the return on capital is going to go down. Again, the exact opposite of Piketty, but again, we could go on and on in this. But that's Varoufakis makes this big deal. So we got to give money to poor people. Drop it from helicopters. Anything you do. I saw another guy who said, no, the way to do it is not taxes. We don't want taxes to do it. But because we have deflation, negative inflation, and what we want is inflation, because inflation will allow us to get rid of all the debt that all these countries have amassed, then what we should really do is just print money, give it to people. They will spend it. That'll create economic activity. That'll get unemployment down. That'll create, wealth, and inflation will go up, so Japan will be able to pay back its debt. It's just the most bizarre. I don't know where people study economics. But, there's a certain element of truth there, of course, to all these things. There's elements of truth. It's true that inflation is very good for people who owe money and very bad for people who owed money. So if you want to screw bondholders and benefit government, then you want massive inflation. Of course, since government controls inflation, that's what they're trying to create. And what frustrates them to no end is they're not able to inflate their way out of the debt situation they have. And that's why they keep trying to monetize the debt in any way that they can, basically print money like crazy, and it's not working, and that's frustrating for them. Now, why it doesn't work is another topic. Okay, here's another one. What a minimum income does is it allows, what the guaranteed minimum income, it allows people, individuals, to take risks and be creative. They don't have to worry about where food is going to come to their table tomorrow, so they can go off and they can really innovate. They can really create new stuff. They can take risks. And Varoufakis makes a big deal out of this. Again, it makes sense. And we'll connect this to a moral point he makes in a minute. These are all economic arguments. All right. Now, this is a big one that Varoufakis makes. Again, what's his name? Charles Murray would never make an argument like this, but it's kind of fun to go through because it's also connected to the inequality debate. And it's connected to You Didn't Build That by Obama and Elizabeth Warren. So Varoufakis, in a speech that he gave, says, look, basic income is an opportunity for us on the left to overturn the current false narrative about capitalism. And what is the false narrative about capitalism? The false narrative about capitalism is that private production of wealth that all wealth is privately produced and then is confiscated from private producers and redistributed for social purposes. He says that's just false. That is a lie. That's not true. He says wealth is produced collectively. And it's then confiscated by private individuals for their own benefit. And the taxes are just a way to redistribute the wealth that was produced by the people it's redistributed to. So he calls taxes just, or he calls the basic income a dividend. So you take the money away from rich people who don't really produce the wealth. They've expropriated the wealth from the fact that we all produce the wealth, and you're giving the money back. So Varoufakis, and I like Varoufakis because he's a Marxist who's trying to couch what he says in terms that appeal to non-Marxists. And you can tell he's a complete idiot and he's smart at the same time. So he's come up with really original variations on this kind of stuff, which is, I find really, really interesting. And he seems to be at the cutting edge of where the left is in terms of their economic arguments. So it's good to follow him and note what he does. So this is You Didn't Build That. You Didn't Build It. Wealth is social. And if it's social, the fact that some people are not involved in its creation doesn't matter. They're part of society and they deserve a minimum income. They deserve a minimum income. So all we're doing is and he says, Varoufakis says, every single technology in the iPhone was created by government grants. Now, this is a big, big claim of the left. They now are claiming this all the time, that technology is all created by government grants and government investment and government basic funding. It's a big lie, and it's a big distortion. Again, I'm not going to talk about it now. We'll talk about it some other time. But it's becoming bigger and bigger. They're repeating it. You know, the left is very good at repeating something over and over and over and over again. And by repeating it over and over and over again, people start absorbing it and accepting as if it's true. Okay, so the idea is that the iPhone is a social product. It's not Steve Jobs. It's not Apple. We all did it. And even those who weren't participating because they were unemployed or they're welfare recipients, they deserve it because they're part of our society and it's a collective thing. It really is shocking. So, you know, one of the reasons I took on this topic and wanted to talk about the basic income is because so many issues come in here. So many different issues come into play when we talk about this. They bring out their entire phony economics, their entire phony morality, and they bring it in. That's a big part of it, but I want to go over some of the moral arguments they make in favor of this. But we're going to do that after a quick break, And then we'll come back and we'll talk about the mall arguments they
made.
The
Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before. The first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
You've heard the endless warnings. Economic inequality is growing and will continue to grow. But the question almost no one asks is, who cares? It's an important question. Economic inequality has nothing to do with poverty. In some countries, people are relatively equal and extremely poor. In other countries, like the United States, people are relatively unequal, and the vast majority of people are, by world standards, extremely rich. Inequality just means there's a gap between what different people earn, and the gap can grow even if every single individual is becoming better off. And that's really the story of capitalism. Economic progress makes us all better off, just at different rates. So, why should we care about inequality? For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
ARI is now accepting applications for the Junior Fellows Program in Policy Research and Legal Studies. The program is designed for individuals who are seriously considering an intellectual career, want to gain real-world experience and training, and are interested in the application of objectivism to policy issues. The application deadline is June 15, 2016. To learn more, visit AynRand.org/JFP.
All right, so we're talking about the basic minimum income, universal. Everybody gets a check. If you're unemployed, if you and this replaces all welfare programs. It replaces Social Security, Medicare. This is the proposal Charles Murray is making. So let's see some of the – we talked about some of the economic arguments, right? It's more efficient. We've got a problem of unemployment potentially in the future. We'll increase aggregate demand, which is stupid, but anyway, allows individuals to take risks and be creative without starving. It creates inflation, which is good for the states, and on and on and on. And of course, the bigger one the most important one, which is not so much economic, but philosophical, is the idea that you didn't build it. Everything is created collectively by the state. The distribution of wealth right now is unfair. Anyway, this is an opportunity to redistribute wealth. Now, note that that is a leftist argument, that you don't see that on the libertarian side. We'll get to some of the libertarian arguments in a minute. Okay, what are some of the other arguments? Freedom. What does freedom mean if your only option is to take job X or starve? You hear this from leftists all the time. This is a classical Marxist Marxist nonsense, right? You're not free if you have an empty stomach. You're not free if the only guy offering jobs in your neighborhood is a sweatshop, and your only option to that is starvation. I mean, that so belittles human beings. It so belittles the human being's capacity to innovate, to create, to be entrepreneurial, to farm, to find other jobs. It is also stupid because that's never been the case under capitalism. People always have choices. And it's a negation of the concept of freedom. Freedom is not about maximizing your options. Freedom is about the lack of coercion. Again, but this is an argument that Varoufakis makes. I mean, he says, look, you have a right to a basic standard of living. You have a right to a floor. You have a right to some basic. So, and I've noticed a number of people using this analogy. Instead of calling it a safety net, nets are no good. They catch you when you're falling. They don't do anything to help you rise up again. You get entangled in the net, so you get stuck, and you don't go anywhere. All right? So what we need instead of a net is a floor. A floor you can stand on, you can build something with, you can improve yourself off of. It's a launching pad for you to make yourself a better person. So, you know, it's necessary for freedom because they define freedom as having many choices. It's starvation can be one of them. And it's necessary for basic just life, the basic standard of living. But this is, of course, the negation of the whole concept of rights. Charles Murray says that if we do this, this will encourage charity. It'll certainly encourage personal responsibility, because note one of the benefits of this. One of the great benefits of this is that instead of the state telling you what you should do with your money if you're poor and what deserves subsidization, what doesn't, I don't know, housing subsidies or healthcare subsidies or education subsidies. Now they're giving you money and you can do whatever you want with it, including, by the way, spend it all on drugs and alcohol. But Charles Murray says, it imposes individual responsibility. You get to decide what to do with the money you get, rather than some government bureaucracy getting to decide how to divvy up the money. So you get to make that decision. All right. And then it also encourages charity, because the government's not there with a million kind of safety nets. It establishes a floor. And that floor might not be good enough for some people. If they're gonna suffer in spite of this floor, for example, if they use all the money you give them for alcohol and drugs, private charity is gonna have to step in. Now, why can't we just rely on private charity? Why do we need to create the floor? That I haven't heard an answer. But if private charity is so good, if private charity could plug all the holes, why do we need to even need it? Right. All right. What else? This one is kind of interesting, and this is a libertarian argument. You see this a lot if you go to a blog called Bleeding Heart Libertarians. Bleeding Heart Libertarians. So the Bleeding Heart Libertarian argument is this. Look, the distribution of wealth today has been, to a large extent, determined by injustices that have happened in the distant past. You know, there are a lot of people today who are rich in Europe because their ancestors were aristocrats and stole their wealth. And from that stealing of wealth, they get to maintain, they've maintained that wealth somehow, and they've gotten advantages that they wouldn't have had if not for the injustice of the past. The most obvious example of this is the black community in America has suffered individuals within the Black community suffer egregiously from racism, which is absolutely the case, and suffered because they ancestors and great-great-great ancestors were slaves. You know, so a massive injustice has been committed against Black people in America. Absolutely true. I agree with that completely. Right. And therefore, the whole distribution of wealth today, some of our ancestors were slave owners, some of our ancestors exploited Blacks in other ways, and Blacks never had the opportunity, so they are very poor, and part of that is historic, and so on. We got to get past that. And we can't. We can't just say, okay, we start now and we have a free market. So libertarians say, look, we love free markets if they are true reflections of people's production, meritocracies. But they're not, because there's history, because there's injustice in history. So as a consequence of that, what we need is a period of adjustment. What we need is to compensate for past injustices. And the way to compensate for past injustice is we can't do it on a case-by-case basis. We can't do it individual by individual. It's too complex. It's too hard. It's too difficult to figure out, right? So we're just going to assume that poor people are poor because of past injustices and rich people are rich because of past injustices. We're going to do a redistribution of wealth at some basic level, not too much, just this minimum of income stuff. Then we're going to have a free market on top of that. Nothing else other than that. So that should clear all the injustices out. Now that smacks of so much collectivism. Ugh, awful. But that, you know, that's their claim, right? And finally, Murray also says reduces paternalism. So, okay. So, all right. So we made the argument, left's argument, right's argument, Charles Murray's argument for why this is good. And I'm kind of curious if, what do you think? I mean, I'm curious on the chat. I don't have time really to take some phone calls, but what do you think? I mean, where do you fall down on this? If this could really replace it all, granted that we don't, as objectivists and those of you listening who know me, I don't accept any of those arguments, and except maybe the efficiency argument. I think the efficiency argument is the only real valid argument there. And I do like Charles Murray's idea about this takes away paternalism. It takes away paternalistic government telling you how to spend your money. And if you're poor, you know, you get a check and you're treated like an adult and you're treated responsibly and you get. So I actually like those two arguments. I like the economic efficiency argument. And I like the lack of paternalism. So in a world where I could replace the existing system with this system, those arguments are appealing to me, right? Those arguments are appealing to me. But what do you think? Would you, if we could snap a finger and actually make the replacement, would you go for it? Would you do it? Now, let's keep education out of it, because education, I think, complicates it and makes it actually more attractive than it really is. So let's keep education out of it. Education is still a government function under this scenario. So, but we're doing Social Security. We're doing healthcare. We're doing all of that, Medicare, Medicaid, all of that we're doing. So what do you think? I'm snapping fingers, right? Snap, 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 snap. Hasn't happened yet. Okay. Would this be appealing? Okay. So let me tell you the argument I would make for yes. And then I'll tell you the argument for no. And then I'll tell you what I really think. Yes. Hey guys, you know, lots of fired bureaucrats, lots of shut down government programs, much more visibility. It's clean. It's easy. It's transparent. You know exactly where your money's going. Much easier if we really were moving towards laissez-faire capitalism to slowly reduce it. Let's say we start at $13,000 and then you say, okay, every year it's going to be cut by $500 so that one day it's zero. Easier to do than all the complexity of doing away with whole programs and how you phase them out. So it's easier to phase out. It's easier to phase out. No government paternalism, transparent, efficient, gets rid of big chunks of government. I like all those things. Oh, and a big one. It would involve dramatic privatization of healthcare, because it would shift us to a private system funded by the government, but private nevertheless seems better to me. Okay, so That's all my pros. And if you look at it that way, yeah, it's still wrong. It's still involved redistribution of wealth. It's still problematic on a rights, from a rights perspective. It's still evil, but at least as a phase, it's something that can be phased out over time. And therefore, we could move towards freedom easier. And certain industries like healthcare would be privatized much easier under this system, right? What's the con? Now, again, granted that we're going to have some rights violations, and we can't get to laissez-faire capitalism instantly, and we can't just snap our fingers and get to laissez-faire capitalism. This could be a great intermediary step. The big con is that once you endorse a system like this, you're giving an endorsement, a legal, philosophical, political endorsement to the idea that every American citizen is entitled to some kind of minimal income. Everybody's entitled. You are legitimizing entitlements in a way that I don't even think the welfare state does today. And of course, as a consequence, it'll be very, very easy, rather than to phase this out, to increase this, right? To increase it. Once you accept this on principle, that this is okay, and all of the proposals today are not saying this is a way to get rid of all welfare completely and to move us towards complete laissez-faire capitalism. They're saying this is good. This is what we should replace the system with. Then you know there's going to be creep upwards. You know this is not going to end at 10,000 or 13,000 or 15,000. And there are massive other costs to this from an economic perspective, which we haven't talked about. What do you do about regional variation of cost of living? Aren't people in L.A. and San Francisco going to clamor for a bigger slice than people in Ohio or in Indiana, where the cost of living is much lower? How do you adjust for that? Then do you create a bureaucracy, you know, to accommodate the differences in cost of living? It's not easy to do. But again, it's not as simple and efficient as it first appears. And it's got huge incentives for people to lobby to have it increased rather than decreased. It's, you know, what effect does this have on economic growth from a purely economic perspective on future generations? Are you penalizing current generations, or are you penalizing future generations for current generations? You're shifting resources from investment to consumption. Now, again, if it completely replaces everything and it's dollar neutral, maybe this isn't an impact, but it's not clear. What about immigration? Now, I know some of you online who are listening are anti-immigration, but I am not. I'm pro-immigration. This, if you had minimum basic income, would be a massive anti-immigration wedge issue. Because every new person coming in gets a minimal income, whether they're working or not. They get a minimum income, right? Everybody gets it. Everybody gets it. So every immigrant, even a computer programmer, suddenly is perceived as a burden of $13,000 on tips. At the bottom, at the end of the day, it's a right-violating mechanism. This is a rights-violating. We can't be pro this. This is not something you can fight for. It's not something you can support. This is the best case you can make for it. As a transitionary measure towards full laissez-faire capitalism, zero rights violations, government that makes no redistribution of wealth, this might be an important, efficient way to transition from where we are today to where we want to be. But that's the only argument you can make for this. I mean, I think what Charles Murray does is a complete sellout. I think what the libertarians do on this issue is a complete sellout, because that's not how they frame the debate. It has to be framed. If you're going to support this at all, in any way, it has to be framed as a transition to complete and utter freedom, a transition to complete laissez-faire capitalism, a transition to no redistribution of wealth, zero redistribution of wealth. So I'm against any kind of guaranteed minimum income, universal basic income, or whatever they want to call it, unless it is clearly and articulately phrased in the context of a move towards laissez-faire. I'm stuttering. Again, I think this is the impact of Europe. Unless it's phrased in the context of, we know it's rights violating, we know it's wrong, we know it's rights violating, we know it's wrong, but this is a transition. Right? It has to be acknowledged up front what is wrong with this. So, look, nothing is going to change in the world. I'm going to end with this and then give you my aesthetic recommendation of the week. Nothing will change in the world unless we change the fundamental philosophical views. Nothing will change in the world unless we convince people that they don't have a right to take from person A and give to person B, that rights can never be violated. Nothing will change in the world. I mean, importantly change. Yeah, we can have better periods and worse periods. I'm not saying that it's all or nothing, but we're not going to get all. We're not going to get radical change. We're not going to get laissez-faire capitalism. We're not going to get significant movement towards laissez-faire capitalism unless we can convince people that all of these are rights violations. And if we can convince them of that, then we have to advocate for complete laissez-faire capitalism, for complete separation of state from economics, for no redistribution of wealth. And then, under those terms, when people are convinced, we can say, look, in the transition to, this is one way we could do it without too much damage or without too much dislocation. And within a generation, it's gone. And within a generation, we have complete laissez-faire capitalism. Okay. Now, when I said I came back from Europe with something, what I meant was jet lag. So my mind is working very slow this morning. So I apologize if that came across on the show. I have been away from home. As of yesterday, I was away from home for 4 weeks. So 4 weeks of nonstop travel, every day a different country, at least at least 1 week of that, all over the place, more than one event a week. So at some point we'll talk about that, but it was a lot of fun and I think productive, but exhausting. So I'm tired and I've got one more show to go in Chicago in a week. I'd love to have that chip in my brain so they could give me a boost of energy. And by the way, you can today put an arm on somebody who doesn't have an arm, connect that artificial electronic arm to his nervous system, and he can control it with his thoughts. So the idea of a chip in a brain is not that far removed. All right. I have a recommendation for you guys. So on the planes, While I was flying across the world, I was watching this really good show. As usual, it's not made in America; it's made in the UK. You Brits know how to make television, and it's based on a book by an author who I like. And some of you will be shocked by this, but I like John le Carré, the author of espionage novels. Now, he is a socialist. He is a moral equivalency between capitalism and communism and West and East and all kinds of, there's a lot of bad stuff in John le Carré's novels. Heroes are so, but once in a while, now I've read a lot of his books and I've loved them all. And I love George Smiley, who is a hero of many of the books, and he writes smart fiction. He writes about intelligent people solving problems. It's the opposite of an action movie. Now, granted, his villains are often businessmen, and in this show, the villain is a businessman, and the connection between business and the villainy is strongly hinted at least in the few early episodes. It kind of goes away later on, and yet the show is really good. It's called The Night Manager. And I'm told here that it's directed by a Danish director, Susan Beyer. And it was six episodes, an hour each, suspenseful, well-directed, well-acted, smart. Did I say intelligent? But just well done. Some action, more action than is typical in a John le Carré novel. The hero is a hero. There's no equivocation about his heroism. There's no doubt about his motivations. He's not an anti-hero. He's not a mixed hero. He is just a hero. And it's excellent. It's excellently acted, excellently made, excellently produced, and it's good. It's a good deal. So I watched it on iTunes. I downloaded all six episodes and watched it on iTunes. I know it's on television in the U.S. or has been. I don't know if it's on Netflix or other places, but it's very good. Somebody mentioned here another of his movies called Constant Gardener. I didn't watch that because that's about the evil of pharmaceutical companies. That I cannot tolerate. There are limits to even my ability to tolerate this stuff. The Russia House was very good. I enjoyed The Russia House with Sean Connery and was it Michelle Pfeiffer? Yeah, it was very good. Anyway, Night Manager, highly recommend. I think the actor who plays the hero in The Night Manager, my guess he's going to be the next James Bond. He's got the James Bond look. If you notice when you watch the movie, the series, you've got the music in it is very James Bond-like. They're trying to make that connection. At some point, the hero orders a martini, and just the way he orders it, you kind of think, you know, he's prepping. He's prepping to be the next James Bond. So that would be very cool. He's a good actor. I really enjoyed him. It's got Hugh Laurie, who I love. I love him from the days of Blackadder. And by the way, if you've never seen Blackadder, one of the funniest shows in all of human history, and it had Hugh Laurie in it, where he played a complete idiot. It was hysterical. And of course, he was in House. And he's very good. He's very good in the show. So an excellent show, very well done. Highly recommend. Good values, and a real hero for a change. Real hero. None of this mixed stuff. Look, I'm not endorsing John le Carré or any of his points of view, but he's a good author. He writes good books. He's horrible. His politics are horrible on so many different fronts. Smiley's People with Alec Guinness. There are other TV shows that have been done from his books, which I think they're just intelligent and smart and thoughtful and challenge you and fun to watch. And I had another thought of something else I was going to recommend in this context, but in the final 2 minutes, it's faded on me. How ridiculous is that? All right. So, strongly recommend. I really like Hugh Laurie, like lots of his stuff. So if you want a second recommendation, go watch Blackadder. Blackadder with Rowan Atkinson and Hugh Laurie, and four seasons, fabulous seasons, and so on. And unfortunately, I'm not gonna. I let me just quickly for the Europeans over there. I don't know when I'm gonna be in Belgrade, Serbia next. My next trip is probably going to be involve Moscow, Kiev, Tbilisi, Poland, Madrid, London. I'm not sure what else. All right. Cool. Everybody have a great week. It's good to be back in the U.S. And I will be back actually doing the show myself. Oh, Romania on top of all those, Romania. I'll be doing the show myself next week, same time, same place. See you there. Thanks for listening to the Ron Brooks Show. Have a great week. Bye. And where's my closing music? Maybe it's that.